got a scratchy throat. He thought maybe he shouldn't expose everybody else, and so we brought the kids. So it's just a little bit of a rush this morning. Glad to see everybody out. If you have your New Testament, you might be turning to the book of Luke. We'll be picking up there very shortly. Starting in the 8th chapter, it's the 1st of March. The year is progressing very rapidly. We are not progressing as rapidly in Luke as the year is progressing. But I think we're studying good stuff, and I've appreciated everybody's comments and participation in the class. So we're just going to see where we get to, and then we may wind up picking up second half in another quarter. We've got other plans for next quarter, so we'll just see what happens here. All right, before we start this morning, I'm going to ask Josh, if you would, to lead us in a word of prayer, please. As we think just briefly about what we've been looking at so far in Luke, Luke, being mostly chronological, started off with the birth and the early childhood of Christ. We got some good stories in there and an idea of him growing up, growing in favor and in stature. And then this early ministry with John the Baptist coming in and being the forerunner, the one who would go before. Let's see if we can get that down where it's not quite as noisy. And we see that interaction briefly between John the Baptist and Jesus, and then we see John the Baptist. Last week we picked up with him asking that question about whether this was the Messiah. And we talked about the fact that all that Jesus was doing in this ministry, mostly in Galilee, in the chapters we've been studying since that start of his ministry, has been in the region of Galilee, all around the Sea of Galilee there. Winding up, what is he teaching? What is he trying to do? And I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that he's really teaching people that they need to turn back to God. But what was their concept of God? It was from what they had in the Old Testament scriptures. And he's not really changing the law at that point. What he is teaching them how to do is to better understand the principles that God really had been wanting for them always in their lives. And he's trying to get them closer to God, trying to bring them back. But he's also on this journey, is he not? And Jesus knows where that journey is going to end. It's going to end in Jerusalem. And it's going to end with him on a cross. And so that's what he's looking forward to. And all of his ministry is kind of overshadowed by that as we're looking at his teaching. So in this chapter 8, it kind of finishes up the work that he's doing right there around the Sea of Galilee. And many of the things in here are in this chapter and in chapter 9 are pretty well known. So we're going to go kind of rapidly through this one as time permits. But obviously, if you have any questions or anything, please, you know, bring them out. But it starts in chapter 8, verse 1. Soon afterwards, after the events that had been going on in chapter 7, it says that he began going around from one city and village to another, proclaiming and preaching the kingdom of God, and the 12 were with him. I want to stop there for a second, because this is the first time that it's kind of given us this summary of his message. So if he's been teaching people to come back to God, what is this whole concept of the kingdom of God? What's he really teaching people? What's he bringing up? Think back for a second. When John the Baptist sent his disciples and said, "Is this the one?" How was it that Jesus answered? Did he go, "Yes, I'm the one"? What's that? Yeah, and he had them go with him for a day, right? And witness all that was going on. And they said, "Now go back to John the Baptist and tell him what? Tell him what you've seen." And then he referenced an Old Testament prophecy, did he not, out of Isaiah, when he said that the lame are walking and the blind are seeing and the deaf are hearing and the dead are being raised. And all of those we had seen in the work of Jesus up at this point, these people are seeing these miracles, which were all signs of a coming kingdom. Now, that's where a lot of people are having this disagreement, right? And some of the people, as we discussed last week, they wanted to make him king. That wasn't what Jesus wanted. They were trying to then, if he wasn't going to be the king, get rid of him. And so there's all of these interplay with the people going on, but it says here that he's going around and he's teaching the kingdom. He's letting people, or trying to prepare people for what's going to come and for this big change that's going to happen. So how then, and he's got 12 with him, and it says, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and sicknesses, Mary, who was called Magdalene, and from the seven demons gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others who were contributing to their support out of their private means. Now, that's an interesting verse also, because sometimes you don't think about Jesus is going around, he's preaching, he's teaching, he's got 12 disciples with him. How do they live? What's their job? Sometimes we forget that you still got to eat, right? And we're going to see in a minute, you still got to sleep somewhere. But Jesus, what was his response? He's going to say it in a little bit, but most everybody's familiar with it. Somebody said, I'm going to follow you. And what did Jesus say? I don't even have a place that I sleep, okay? Jesus was itinerant at this point. He's just moving from one place to the other. He is dependent on the goodwill of those who are following him and his disciples as well. And so they are supporting him as it goes. But it's kind of interesting, this list here. Anything catch your eye when you start looking at the list? Herod's steward. Doesn't that kind of jump out at you? So here is a woman who is the wife of Herod's steward, and she is supporting Jesus out of her means, and others are helping to support. Does that mean that no men were helping to support? No. It's just that he's calling out here that even as Jesus is spreading his word, a lot of people are believing in him enough that they are contributing to this. They are helping to support him and his disciples because they believe in the message. And so this large crowd comes together. And beginning in verse 4, we'll have the, verse 4. This large crowd comes together and from various cities, and they were journeying to him, and he spoke by way of a parable. And this is the parable of the sower. We'll read through it real quickly, but we've been through this a lot, so I won't spend a lot of time here. He said, the sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell beside the road, and it was trampled underfoot, and the birds of the air ate it up. Other seed fell on the rocky soil, and soon as it grew up, it withered away because it had no moisture. And other seed fell among the thorns, and the thorns grew up, and with it choked out. And the other seed fell into good soil and grew up and produced a crop 100 times as great. And as he said these things, he would call out, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. Now he's telling a parable. And in the context of what he's teaching, it says these crowds are coming from all over to listen to him, to hear him talk. And sometimes, is he pretty straightforward about what he's teaching them to do? Sometimes he's very straightforward. Other times, you get these stories, these parables. And this one is, I think, fairly straightforward, but he's got a large crowd. And what is his message to this crowd in this parable?
Well,
that seems pretty straightforward. And of course, we have the advantage of having the interpretation afterwards, right? Because even his disciples are going, what was this? But I think the crowds that are listening, as Jesus is understanding, is everyone who's there is curious. They've come out to listen to him. But is everyone going to believe what he says? Is everyone going to follow him? And I think that's an interesting lesson as we kind of put it in that context, because what's Jesus doing? He's out there working miracles. He's teaching in a way that they just haven't heard before. And yet, even with all that he had and the power and the authority that he taught with, not everybody believed him. So is it any wonder that when we have the word today, not everybody is going to pay attention to it? It's just people haven't changed all that much, have they? And Jesus is recognizing that in this parable, and he's letting his followers know, I know what's going on. I mean, from his perspective, I think Jesus is telling his followers, I have no misconceptions about how this is going to go. What's going to happen? A lot of you, you're here, you're listening. Yeah, it's rocky. You're not going to believe it no matter what you see. Others, you're going to try to follow along. You're going to be really, really, you know, enthusiastic about this for a little while. But there will be some. And those some are what we're looking, what Jesus is looking for. Those who will latch on and produce a hundredfold. Absolutely. And that's why I think not only does it help us understand people one night, it helps us understand that the world is like that and that it's not our fault. You know, what's our responsibility? Our responsibility isn't to convert everybody. Our responsibility is to teach, right? That's what our responsibility is. And so we need to fulfill our responsibility and let God take care of his side. So his disciples didn't quite understand this. They began questioning him as to what this parable means. And he said to them, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom, but to the rest it is parables, so that seeing they may see and hearing they may not understand. Now he's got two phrases there, and I want to kind of contrast those. It says, as he's teaching the people, what is Jesus telling them? He tells them this parable, and then he cries out, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. Now, put yourself in the place of those who are standing there listening to him, and he says, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. And everybody's thinking, I heard it the first time. What does he mean by that? Is it just hearing? What is it? Hearing and understanding, right? Hearing and understanding. Hearing and putting it into practice. That's what he's really talking about there. And a lot of the folks there are not going to follow that. And he says, follows it up with his disciples by this quote again from Isaiah, seeing, they may not see, and hearing, they may not understand. A lot of people saw him, a lot of people heard him, not everybody understood the message. Now the parable is this, the seed is the word of God. Those beside the road are those who have heard, and the devil comes and takes away the word from their heart so that they will not believe and be saved. And those on the rocky soil are those who, when they hear, receive the word and with joy, and these have no firm root. They believe for a while, and in the time of temptation, they fall away. And the seed which fell among the thorns, these are the ones who have heard, and as they go on their way, they are choked with worries and riches and pleasures of this life and bring no fruit to maturity. But the seed in the good soil, these are the ones who have heard the word in an honest and good heart and hold it fast, and bear fruit with perseverance. Now, we've covered lots of lessons on these, and we could spend a long time here, but I still think we need to kind of consider, as we look at the soils that are our hearts, that we want to be the good soil, right? But do we find ourselves in some of the other soils on occasion? And I think that's, you know, as Mark's been teaching lessons on, you know, slaying giants and pulling thorns, you got to weed the garden occasionally, too. And sometimes when the weeds and things and the thorns start choking out, that's when we start recognizing we're in danger of being in that other soil. And there's a way to fix that, and that's to clean it out. So that's what Jesus is teaching them. He's teaching them that it's not that you're just predestined to be one of these. It's the things that happen in your life and that you let happen that determine what kind of soil you're going to be. So he wants the people to follow him. Now, no one, after lighting a lamp, covers it over with a container or puts it under a bed, but he puts it on a lampstand so that those who come in may see the light. For nothing is hidden that will not become evident, nor anything secret that will not be known and come to light. So take care how you listen, for whoever has, to him more shall be given, and whoever does not have, even what he thinks he has, shall be taken away from him. Now, there's another parable that's a little on the scratch your head side for a little bit as you're looking at it. And he doesn't give us the explanation here, but there's other places. So, again, people following him, they're listening to him, they're thinking about what he has to say, and he comes up with, do you take a light that's on a hill, or a light, what do? You put it on a hill or you put it under a basket? Well, that's kind of obvious, right? But is the story really about lights? What's he trying to get across to them? Absolutely. Yeah, I think part of it is it shouldn't be, but I also think when you start looking at it and compare it to the parable of the sower that was just before, right? How are you going to know if you're seeing somebody that's in that good soil? What's it say the sign is going to be that somebody's in good soil? They're producing, right? That's kind of hard to hide, isn't it? If you can't tell because there's no fruit, then the likelihood is you're kind of in one of the other soils. Where, maybe we don't know. We don't have the ability to read the hearts and minds of people like Jesus did. But Jesus gave us another guideline a little later on. He said, by their fruits, what? You will know them. By your fruits, people will know you. That can be part of it. And part of that is the way you live and how you talk and how you dress and your actions at work and at school and interactions with others. All of that comes into play for people to see and understand what kind of person you are. That's the light reflection. But I think we have to look at it from both sides of that, right? How do people see me? But does it not give us a window into looking at other people as well? And so I think it's a two ways there. And, you know, are we the light or are we looking at the light? And the answer is yes. That's part of the responsibilities that we have. So Jesus is telling them, as they're following him and they're soaking up these words, he's going, you got another choice to make here, right? First, they got to pick out which kind of ground they are. And then they got to decide, okay, I really want to follow this man. Now, what does that mean? Light on a hill or light under a basket? You can't hide it. Wasn't that part of Nicodemus when he came to Jesus? How did he come to Jesus? By night. Why was that? I'm suspecting he didn't want his fellow members of the council to see that he was the one that was sneaking in and asking questions. So at some point, he's going to have to face this question of, does he then make a decision to let his light shine? So Jesus is giving them all of these parables, and he's drawing these lines that they must figure out where they stand. And that's part of the problem with listening to a teacher like Jesus, is it makes you think, it makes you analyze, it makes you try to figure out where you are. And his mothers and brothers came to him, and they were unable to get to him because of the crowd. And it was reported to him, your mother and your brothers are standing outside wishing to see you. But he answered and said to them, my mother and my brothers are these who hear the word of God and do it. So he's in this area where his siblings and his mother still live. Doesn't mention his father, so many people believe that by this time maybe Joseph has died. We don't know. But I've always wondered if maybe James was one of those who was on the outside trying to get in. We don't know a lot about James other than some of the early writings that tell us that he might not have been the most gracious of followers of Jesus at first, but certainly became one later, right? And so they're on the outside, they're looking in, they want to see Jesus, and you'd think that family could get a front row seat, right? And they're having trouble. And when they tell Jesus, what's his response? I got my family, right? I got my family. That's an interesting thing, because was he really trying to put his mom down or put his brothers or sisters down? No, that wasn't the point at all. What he was trying to say was, there are a lot of important people here. These people have come to listen, and Jesus is no respecter of persons. They've come out. He's going to spend the time that it takes to be with them as well. So Jesus is giving them an important lesson even here on just the sidelines of who's important. And what do we need to do?
Well, and to take a little further, it is your brothers and sisters in Christ, you know, they are going to be in the kingdom. They are more important
Absolutely. Absolutely. And his life was displaying that he had no partiality, that he was accepting of everyone that would come. And we've seen this right even in the people that it talks about him touching. Who has he approached and worked with that others wouldn't even have given the time of day or even looked at? And yet Jesus was there. And they were just as important. So there was no soul that Jesus didn't consider important before God. And all of them were family. So he gives them just one lesson after another. And I read all of this, and I know it's kind of combined into a short piece and all. But when you get to the next one, and it says that on one of those days, his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, let's go over to the other side of the lake. Can you imagine that how busy and crowded Jesus' life was? And probably some times when it was just, we needed to get away from the crowds a little. So I kind of view this as, you know, we haven't been to the other side of the lake in a while. We could either walk to over there, around the lake, through the villages, or we can do what? We can get in a boat, and we can be on the water for a while, and away from the crowds. And in fact, what's one of the first things that happens? It says as they're sailing, he fell asleep. Why did he fall asleep? He's tired. I know what that's like. All of us know what that's like, right? Where you just get to a point where you're tired. He's in a boat. This is not the most comfortable places, but he lays down and he goes to sleep. And they began to be, and a fierce gale of wind descended on the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger. And they came to Jesus and woke him up saying, Master, Master, we are perishing. And he got up and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. And he said to them, where is your faith? And they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? Oh. That's a good question, so let's think about it in the context of this. What have the disciples, those who are with him in the boat, now this is, if he's got all of his disciples, that's at least 12, right? So this isn't like a dinghy, right? I mean, my dad, we had a little 14-foot aluminum boat with an 18-horse Johnson motor on it that we twiddled around in the lakes of Central Florida in. You could not have put 12 people in that boat, okay? We were lucky when we got four or five in there that you still had room to move around without hitting each other. So this is a little bigger boat, probably something like the boat from the Sea of Galilee or whatever. Peter and John, James and John are fishermen, so they certainly know how to handle the boat. So it's large enough craft that these people are in it. What have they seen Jesus do just in the previous chapters as they've been working with him probably for the last at least couple of years? He's done what? He raised somebody from the dead. He's healed numerous people. Lepers. Leprosy was one of those dreaded things, and they've watched him turn lepers from blighted to white as snow, right, and clean. All of these things they've watched. And each one, I mean, if you're watching this man do these things, how's it affecting you? And you're looking at, it's just amazing what he could do. But a lot of it, now, go back to, it's not recorded in Luke, but it's Matthew's like, what was his first, actually in John, what was his first miracle that they had seen, that they'd already seen by this point? Well, John records the seven signs, right? So first one that he had seen was he turned this water into wine. So he's got some control over the elements and things. But a lot of the others are these healings and these dealing with people and casting out demons, right? They've seen that. But for some reason, when you're in the eye of a hurricane, that looks different, doesn't it? We think of that as maybe a different kind of power. Doctors attempt to help people, right? And sometimes they can. And so while it's miraculous and amazing that someone can lay their hands on them and immediately cure them, how good are we yet at even predicting the weather, much less affecting the weather? It's just not in our ability, is it? Not yet. Maybe we'll get there, you know, with weather control satellites or something someday. That's a science fiction kind of thing that everybody keeps talking about. Yeah, we'll see. Because when this comes up, and they're afraid. Now, this is the acknowledged Son of God with them in the boat. And the boat is in danger of being swamped. And I'm thinking there's wind, there's waves, there's rocking. Jesus is still asleep because he's tired. And instead of thinking, how could the elements swallow this man that we've seen do so much? What's their fear? They think they're all going to die. Here's a man who's raised the dead, but they think they're all going to die. And when Jesus gets up, he simply says, stop that. Peace. I don't even envision him raising his voice. It's more like, this is an inconvenience. Just stop. And what happens? This is a gale, okay? This is heavy winds on the lake. And the waves are sloshing all over the place. Anybody been out on a boat when it's been really windy and choppy and whatnot? Yeah. And that was my one time of getting really seasick. Don't want to do that again. And Jesus just says, stop. And it does. What does this demonstrate to the disciples? Absolute. And I think now they're beginning to get a little better feel for, even though their concept of the Son of God, okay, I'm not sure that they equated Jesus with equal to God up until this point. The being God with us. Who is it in the Old Testament that controls the elements? It's God. When God talks about, you know, did they have in their stories, in their knowledge, stories of control over the elements that God had exercised? What would be one of the most famous ones? Okay, there's the flood. He opened the gates of the heavens and the seas and flooded the earth. What else? Red Sea. We've got the winds that come up and create a dry channel that a couple of million people walk across. What's that? He held the sun for a day that it didn't go down. So do we have evidence in the Old Testament of God controlling the elements? Absolutely. But had Jesus really exercised that kind of control before? Not in their eyes. And so for him to just go, peace, still, and everything to obey him? Yeah, it's a little wonder that they looked and said, who is this? Now, do they, in their hearts, you think they know at that point who they're dealing with? I think that's bringing it home. It's bringing it home that there's more here than just someone who is a prophet, someone who has the power of God.
You know, that's what they were probably expecting. They needed him awake so that he could invoke God, that he could pray, and then maybe calm the storm down a little bit. But Jesus goes right to stop it.
Yeah.
And in their minds, as far as the expectation of the kingdom, they're probably going, this guy's going to roll right over the world.
That's a good point. Somebody who can call up storms or still storms, yeah. Yeah, how's he going to do fair against the Romans? And, you know, and even Jesus admitted that that was the case, right? When at the garden, when he's being taken, when Peter, and he says, If I didn't want to be taken, what would I do? I'd call leagues of angels. You know, this just wouldn't happen. So yeah, they're seeing the power of the one who is the king, but not quite like they expect. So he calms the storm. But they go across into the country of the Gerasenes. And this is another one that we're pretty familiar with. He comes onto this land. He's met by a man from the city who's possessed with demons and who had not put on any clothing for a long time. He's not living in a house, but in tombs. Seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would break his bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. And now there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain, and the demons implored him to permit them to enter the swine, and he gave them permission. Demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. And when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away and reported it into the city and out in the country. And the people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they became frightened. And those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been made well. And all the people of the country of the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to leave them, for they were gripped with great fear, and he got into the boat and returned. But the man from whom the demons had gone out was begging him that he might accompany him, but he sent him away, saying, "Return to your house and describe what great things God has done for you." So he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. Several interesting things about this. You think this is a primarily Jewish settlement here that he's going to. How do you know? They got pigs, okay? This is one of the ways that archaeologists can tell whether a city was primarily Jewish or not, was when they find the garbage dumps. Garbage dumps are great archaeological finds, because you can tell all kinds of things about what people were eating and, you know, the kinds of things they made. And, of course, they're broken in the garbage dump, but that's okay. You know, you can at least figure them all out. And so they look for pig bones. And if you don't find very many of them, it's likely more of a Jewish settlement in that area than another one. Well, here we've got whole herds of pigs. Now, the main character in this story is one who is possessed by a lot of demons. In fact, what's he called? He says, "What's your name?" And he says, "Legion," okay? That's a lot. Now, did they recognize Jesus? Yeah. Is this man's reputation known in the area? Obviously so. It says that he's in chains and shackles a lot of the time. Who puts those on him? That's the people trying to restrain him. It sounds like there are times when he's kind of okay and kind of not, and when he's not, nobody can withstand him. He just has almost superhuman strength in the way it's described. But Jesus sees this, and once again, he has compassion on him, even though this man's likely not a Jew. He's either a Samaritan or a Gentile. And he calls them out, sends them into the swine. Of course, the swine go crazy and do what? You know, jump off the cliff into the lake, and they all drown. And now we start seeing, how do people react to Jesus? These people have seen a great miracle and seen something incredible also, have they not? What's their reaction? "I'm afraid of this man. I'm afraid of this man." Whether or not they understood anything about his message is unclear, because they just basically said, "We don't want anything to do with somebody who has this kind of power." And their intent was, "Please leave." He destroyed their herds. Their livelihood is a little on the line here, too. That might have played into it. You know, we start looking at how much money he had cost them there in terms of, you know, the economic impact. But still, looking at the miracles, we see that case again of those who witness, those who see, sometimes have different reactions, right? Based on their background, based on what their heart is like, what their intentions are in life. And they're asking him to leave. Now, the poor guy who's healed, I love that phrase. You know, we sometimes we talk about kids going crazy, and then there are times when they sit down, and you know, the phrase that pops to mind is quite often, they're clothed and in their right mind. So sometimes you wonder about demon possession today. Doesn't happen, but yes. But yeah. We don't really know, and it looks like if we put a lot of things together, and this is probably a whole study that we ought to do, you know, ask Mark to do one of these Wednesday night, what does the Bible say about demons? But the reality is we don't see them until we see Jesus on the earth. We see a lot of that possession at the time when Jesus is going to exercise control. That they show up in the apostles' lives after Jesus is gone, right? But what's the balancing factor there? The apostles have the authority to exercise them, to throw them out. When that age of miracles kind of dies off, what do you see about the demons? They're kind of not there anymore. Now, in Revelation, there's some talk about Satan being chained and whatnot, and that's figurative, I understand, but I think the concept is there that God is in control of this, whether or not they have any kind of free reign or not. And so when it was not... When that power of God was not present on the earth to exercise that, guess what? The demons weren't allowed to exercise that power either. So that's kind of the way you see that cycle going. Yes. Exactly. And they went in the pigs, and the pigs drowned. What happened to them then, it doesn't say. But they were fearful of, they knew that Jesus had the power and the authority to do what? To condemn them back to the abyss, right? And so when we look at the power that Satan wields in this world today, I think part of what we have to understand is that does he have the ability to come in and just take us over so that we can do things that we can't control? No. What's that? Not without authority from God. And so even back with Job, you know, we were looking at that. God was in control of that, right? And so we have to make sure that we understand that. That's a fantasy thing when people want to talk about demons wandering the earth today. There are people not in their right mind, but that's not demon possession. That's a different issue. Okay, so we're out of time this morning. I think we got through most of the chapter there. If you got any questions on it, kind of write them down, get them ready, and we'll pick them up next week. Thank you.